Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. And today, joining me in the studio, Gary LeMaster, one of our...
I'm the curmudgeon sitting in for Mike Cosentino this morning.
Yes, one of our producers. Today we have a guest in the studio, John Patrick Pat Willerton. He's a professor at the U of A in Tucson. And he's a specialist in Russia. He's been to Russia many, many times. He went there the first time back in the Soviet area, back in
1982-83.
Very different Russia now than in the Soviet era. And what Pat was talking about when we were talking about earlier is trying to see Russia through Russian eyes and why they look at what's going on in their country very differently than perhaps we do, why they look at their leadership differently than we do. And let's start with, you know, Pat has kind of a striking phrase about where Russia is now compared to where Russia was in the past.
Right. Yeah, you know, I've had the good fortune to be visiting Russia regularly since 1982. And when I first lived there, arriving, I just made the decision that I really wanted to try to experience Russia on its terms. This was Soviet times. This was Brezhnev leading the Soviet Union. And I chose to try to leave my American expectations behind. I mean, I'm very much an American. And my Russian friends that I would make later, I had no friends when I arrived, you know, would comment, "You're such an individual, Pat. You know, we like that about you, but you're not a Russian in that regard." And I guess I'm not. But what I found in having been there for a good number of years off and on and making friends and going through their lives over 25 or 30 years is that really never in Russia's over 1,000 year history have Russians had more personal freedom of maneuver than they have right now. And if I were to share just one idea with people about Russia, this is the one I would like them to know. And I would want to add to that this point, that just as we in our country, the United States, we think about our past experience and we judge where we are today in 2013 with maybe where we were when we were young people or when we were starting our careers or starting our families, that our point of reference is our history. It's not what was going on in Sweden or Japan. Likewise for Russians, in the end, their point of reference is really their past. And the truth of the matter is now, with all of their problems, and there are serious problems, and we seem to hear especially about them, there are some really good things happening there.
Maybe
and
we
Russians
only
feel
hear
good.
About their problems, right?
I think
we never
this
hear
is unfortunate.
The positive side.
Yes, and of course it's a mixed bag. And let me say up front, as we are trying to capture Russian thinking, of course there is no one way of thinking. It's like in the United States. We are very divided on issues. We could talk about issues and we could get all kinds of perspectives. What I would want to share when I talk about a Russian perspective would be what I'm going to call a mainstream perspective. And unfortunately, I think the challenge for us living here or outside of Russia is often we bring our own experience and agenda to how we look at things. And then the particular Russians that we may be listening to often are Russians that they are Russian, but they may not necessarily represent the mainstream. The average Russian has not been to the United States or the West. The average Russian doesn't speak English. The average Russian doesn't live in Moscow or St. Petersburg. And so I think when we gauge our expectations partly on our experience and then the Russians that are definitely there, but they may only represent 10-15% of the population that speak Russian and travel to the West, this is not necessarily the mainstream.
Since you were in the Soviet Union before its breakup, I'd like to ask you about what I would consider a propaganda image of the United States towards the Soviet Union. when that was going on, the images we got of the Soviet Union was fat women and gray babushkas and long bread lines and lines to get everything else. Yet I heard from friends of mine that visited at that time that the reality was considerably different from that. Is that true?
Well, I lived in Moscow. And I did have opportunity to travel to other parts of the Soviet Union. I visited 7 of the 15 republics. But, you know, you spend a couple of days, a week, 10 days in a place. I don't know how easily you can gauge it. So I have to start by saying I lived in the most prosperous city in the Soviet Union, and my friends were probably of the elite. So I have probably some bias from that standpoint. Having said that, choices were made many years before in the Soviet model that the emphasis of investment was on industry. It was developing their military. They did not invest in consumer goods. So the point is that the one image we had of life as being rather gray, you know, the quality of life from that standpoint being rather modest, it was true because this is not where monies were invested. On the other hand, Russians are a very emotional people. They are a very caring people. And I have to tell you, in my experience, and I arrived there with no friends, I had to carve out a life there, and I did. I was very fortunate. But I was also a sponge. And they picked up very quickly for me. I brought no judgment. I really tried to leave my American values at home, in the sense of, you know, I'm worried about the toilet paper or, you know, with the food, this kind of deal. I went Soviet. I used newspaper, you know, for toilet paper. I did some of this stuff that was, you know, maybe something that I wouldn't do in the United States, but, you know, not the end of the world. I got my hair cut at my friend's barber. I went down to the cafeteria, ate with my Russian friends, and didn't try to maintain my American food in the room, that kind of deal. So I found life manageable, comfortable, but here's my point. The quality of personal relationships was very high, and people invested in family and in friends. And so, you see, I think there was a richness there that we wouldn't see simply on the street.
That's what I saw when I met Russian. I saw a willingness to go the second mile, really, to help each other out, because they lived in a culture that they really had to do that. So
that's
when
right.
I
Absolutely.
Needed a ride in New York, a Russian guy would drive 7 or 8 miles in traffic to give me a lift home, which you wouldn't find from very many Americans. And it was because of the lack of the material stuff that they really developed this sort of sense of connection. There's this soulfulness about Russian people. But we still, even though the Soviet Union is long gone, and even though Soviet power is gone, faded, we still think of the Russians as our enemies. I think many people, particularly in northern Arizona, Russians are still our enemies. Why does that keep lingering? I know there's conflicts between the United States and Russia. I know we have differences. But why does this linger, I used to tell Russians, I said, they don't just hate the Soviet Union, they hate Russians. And this is the part that disturbs me, was the feeling that Americans just didn't, it wasn't just being against Soviet communism, it was being against the Russian people that I found years back. It was kind of disturbing to me. And I wonder if this still isn't lingering.
Well, in my judgment, in winning the Cold War, we, and the West did win the Cold War, we were not forced to confront new realities in a very profound way. And so we could continue on in some ways looking at the world as we had. Look, our approach apparently worked. We won the Cold War. In losing it, and of course, this was not a military defeat in the sense of the Nazi Germany or Japan, where, you know, the West goes in and basically reorganizes the country. The Soviet Union imploded, and they had to resort their own realities. And so there are some lingering influences from Soviet times. But on the other hand, they had to get real. This was the title of the talk I gave here today. Let's get real about Russia. They had to get real about the world. They joined a market system. They're learning about the market. They are becoming capitalists. They are capitalists. We've seen amazing entrepreneurship there. They are developing some kind of new political system. They call it democratic. We are skeptical. It's certainly moving in that direction, but it's going to take a long time. The current Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev had said just a week or two ago, it's going to take us 100 years to develop a democracy. And I didn't hear his comment as some excuse to say we're going to continue being authoritarian. I heard it as an acknowledgement. Democracies are complicated. So I would say that I agree with your point about the challenges we have, that we need to get real about Russia and try to realize that they have been making some big changes. They had to, and it would be to our advantage to be more realistic about them, because the truth of the matter is they can be a great friend of the United States. And my last point, I'm going on here, I think no country has so helped the United States since 9/11 in the struggle against international terror as Russia. And we can discuss that, but they don't get the credit for it. And let me say today, in 2013, I think they have some resentment about that, that they felt they were taken for granted what they've done. So others get the credit. And yet they have done a lot because, as they would say, they have been great victims of that kind of terror.
Well, give us some examples of how Russians, or at least, say, a majority or mainstream Russians, if you want to call them, see Russia differently than Americans see Russia. Say the political, Putin. How differently is he viewed by Russians and by Americans? Because a lot of Russians are opposed to him, right? I mean,
I would say that about 25-30% of the population perhaps really dislikes Putin. I would say 50-60% like him considerably, and the rest are not particularly political. In other words, more people like him than not. Look, he's been the paramount leader for now nearly 13 years. He was president for much of it. He was prime minister, but everybody knew he was the paramount leader. He was the power. And so there is Putin fatigue, as there would be with any leader that's around. But it's an interesting point to note that in a survey conducted about 10 days ago, a scientific, I think, good survey, 55% of Russians said they do not want Putin to be reelected president in 2018. Only 22% said they would like him to be reelected. So I think another 5 years, and you know, maybe they'll feel it's time for a change. How do they see Putin? They see him as a strong leader. They see him as someone that's assertive. They see him as someone that's bringing Russia back as a major actor that is respected by the world, including the United States. They see him as a tough guy when it comes to terror. At the same time, he is a leader who wants to try to restore the safety net that existed in the Soviet times that was totally lost. He does not want to go back to the Soviet Union. He made a very famous remark back in 2000, just before he was elected. He was asked, what should the Russian people think about Soviet Union? And he said the following, and this is to me a very interesting comment made to a Russian audience. He said, anyone who does not regret the collapse of the Soviet Union does not have a heart. Anyone who wants the Soviet Union back does not have a brain. And I think this reflects the way he would look at the world. Can we restore some of the good things that were created in that period, like the safety net, but can we move forward in a democratic market environment?
Maybe you could talk a bit about the political system in Russia. The Soviet Union was famously bureaucratic. How much power does Putin really have? How concentrated is his power?
He has a great deal of power. The system they have now was crafted during the period of Yeltsin, who was the leader of Russia at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev was the head of the Soviet government. Yeltsin was the elected president of the biggest republic, Russia. They had 15 republics, and Russia was the biggest. And at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Gorbachev gave up power in the beginning of 1992, we moved into the new era. Russia Federation emerged. Yeltsin was the leader. They crafted a constitution that was approved by the Russian people at the end of 1993 that gave great power to the presidency, great power to the executive, and to the federal government. There's no doubt that there's no checks and balances and separation of powers strong in the way that we think of it. There is some, but it's weaker. They wanted a strong executive. They felt that the early years of Yeltsin and the last years of Soviet power, the executive was too weak, and they needed somebody that would be forceful. So this was done under Yeltsin. The problem under Yeltsin was that Yeltsin himself was both physically weak. He had a drinking problem. He had heart problems. But he also became very unpopular. So you had a man holding office who himself had very little power in a position that was very powerful. Then he surprisingly retires at the end of 1999, and this little-known prime minister, Putin, becomes president. And now you get this young, energetic guy who quickly builds support because of his assertiveness and the feeling by the Russians that this guy knows what he's doing and he means business. So you get a young guy who's energetic. And he has all the powers in the constitution that his predecessor, Yeltsin, had crafted, and you have a very strong leader. Russians like this. Russians in the old days of the Tsars talked about the little father. The Tsar is the little father. They like this, they like a strong executive, and they differentiate the executive, you know, from what you brought up, the bureaucracy, which they're very critical of. And so it's a bureaucratized system. They have a strong executive. But the notion that we have gone back to the Soviet times, I think, is completely false. There are constraints on Putin. His power is not limitless.
And so they like him because it makes them feel secure to have a strong leader in control of.
Well, the country is coming back. I mean, the bottom line is they like the policy. So we have a middle class that was single digit when he came to power, and now it's estimated to be around 25%, 30% of the population. And this is coming from Western sources that, frankly, are not pro-Putin. Like the British weekly magazine, The Economist, they argue that perhaps 40% of the workforce is middle class. You got 14 IKEAs there. IKEAs, not just in the big cities like Moscow. I'm talking about places like Phoenix, Seattle, and Houston, and Philadelphia. And IKEAs, they're making billions over there, that Swedish company. They service the middle class. You go down those rivers between Moscow and St. Petersburg. You see a barn with a new roof. You see a new fence. You see the house newly painted. You sense somebody's making at least some money, that they're coming back. It's going beyond Moscow. So the country is economically doing better. People have more freedom of maneuver. You don't have an internal passport system like before, where you really couldn't move around the country easily. There's a lot of changes. But bottom line then would be, if I add one other point, when we look at the international system, where Yeltsin seemed weak at times, Gorbachev was viewed as a complete disaster. The Russians look at this guy. They like his assertiveness. He tells it like it is. And so they feel they need the tough leader. One last point. When I lived there in the Soviet times, I happened to be visiting the father of my friend, who was a member of the Communist Party, sitting down to dinner. My friend wasn't there. And he said, "I want to make a toast to President Reagan." Now, I'm sitting there. Remember, President Reagan talked about the evil empire. So he went, "I want to make a toast to your president, Pat, President Reagan." He said, "I don't agree with anything that he says, pretty much. But you know something? You are of a great country, and your country deserves a strong leader. So I'll raise my glass to the leader that's strong." Russians like strong leaders. And
always
they see Putin.
Have.
They
yeah.
always have. Their greatest leaders are like Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, Ivan the Terrible, and it's a terrible translation. It's really Ivan the Formidable, not Ivan the Terrible. And I think Putin is viewed in that way, and I predict that in 100 years, Russians will look at Putin as one of their greatest leaders.
But in the West, we just hear criticism of Putin, his authoritarian ways, his Russian assertiveness, right? Gary, they're getting more prosperous and got their act together. Now they're sort of assertive compared to us.
I was going to say the Russian symbol is the bear, and so when you look at strong leaders, I think it kind of fits the culture.
Well, that's a nice point, Gary. That is the symbol, and they take a lot of pride in that. And incidentally, there are some leaders or figures in their history they have regard for who at times would seem quiet and maybe sleepy, like the bear, but when roused, became quite assertive. Now, that would not be the view of Putin. Isn't it interesting about Putin? We have these stereotypical views of Russians, for instance, they like to drink. And frankly, Russians do enjoy vodka. I mean, you just have to prepare yourself when you go over there that you will be taking shots or you will be viewed as not hospitable. In any case, isn't this interesting? He's a teetotaler. Now, how could this happen that a man who does not drink, he is very proud of his family, his two grown daughters, they're of course completely shielded because of fears of terrorism and reprisal, beautiful daughters, very committed to his family. He, as people may know, he's into the martial arts. They talk about him having what the Russians call a samurai warrior ethic. And what that means is this is a tough guy, but he has an ethic. He is a man of integrity. This is the way the Russians see him. In this regard, your point's well taken. We just have a very different view. One last point on this. I was talking to one American international relations scholar who said, I have a very simple explanation for why we don't like Putin. He said, from my standpoint, he said, basically, after Yeltsin and Putin came in, Russia paid off all its international debt. They don't owe us anything. We have no leverage over Russia. However, as the world's leading energy producer, they do have leverage with the West.
And we were talking earlier, Americans think about what would be the alternative to Putin, and you were showing us some statistics about who came in second in the last election. It's the Communist Party, right?
Right, right.
So the alternatives to Putin, when you actually look at them in detail, are not really that great. They're not really
interesting. Not from our standpoint.
Yeah. They're not from our standpoint, I guess apparently not from the Russian standpoint.
Well, there is an element that likes the legacy. Of course, remember, this is a new Communist Party. It's the same old leadership, but this is not a Stalinist party. They're not championing a system of concentration camps and guns. They would be promoting what we'll call a very heavy regulation of the economy, major safety nets, state programs, this kind of thing. But your point is well taken. I think where you're going, Steve, is the fact that the people that we like politically, the pro-Western reformers, and they're there. And I'm going to argue they represent, let's say, 15-20% of the population. And when one of your listeners goes to Russia, and I certainly encourage everyone to go to Russia. It's a beautiful country. There's amazing things happening. It's pretty safe. I mean, it's just as safe as going to Europe, for heaven's sakes. It's a wonderful place to visit. In any case, when you go to Moscow or St. Petersburg, you're meeting one element there, and it's important, but they are no more typical of Russia than if you go to Berkeley, California, or Greenwich Village, New York, that this is the mainstream of the United States. It's a part of the United States. So I think that, we are consistently disappointed in elections, that the pro-Western reformers that we like don't do well. It's not because anyone's stealing votes. It's because in the end they can't pull more than about 20% of the vote.
But it's also that the communists and the neo-fascists do better almost.
They have appeals. The neo-fascists, really taking a hardline stance that, Russia needs to be more assertive in the world, blah, blah, blah. The communists worried about the vagaries of the market. You see, Putin's standing in Russia is more of being in the center. And many on the other side are critical of him that he's not providing enough safety net. He's not assertive enough.
Do the Russians regret no longer being a superpower, having an equal standing with the United States? Or are they kind of goal-oriented to get back to that?
They regret the collapse of their power. Their power had been growing for 500 years, going back to the middle of the 15th century. They were a great power. They achieved the height of their power within one generation of the collapse of the Soviet Union. I'll say symbolically around 1975, when we signed the Helsinki Accords, President Ford did with successor, Brezhnev back in that time. It was Brezhnev in Helsinki, Finland, where we basically acknowledged one another's systems, the East and West acknowledging each other, kind of the two great powers. We accepted each other's great powers. And for them, this was the height of their power globally. Russians regret this. I'll never forget being in my car in Tucson. I'd had a Russian speaker in 1992, and we'd gotten done with the talk. I was taking him out to dinner. Frankly, I was a little short on cash. I think we were going to Coco's or something. We weren't going to the Ritz. But we're in my little car, and we had the NPR on, and they were saying, as we were listening, his English was fabulous. They were saying on the show, India has just offered financial aid to Russia. And I watched I'm driving. He's in the passenger seat. I watched my friend slump into the seat. And he turned to me and said, Pat, this is what it's come to. This is what it's come to. India is offering us help. What happened? So yes, they regret this. They would like to come back. They know they will never be where they were. I think they would like to see more of a multipolar world, and they will be one of the poles.
So Russian regretted not so much the fall of the system of the Soviet era, but the fact that they were no longer the power that they once were.
Well, I think there are regrets about the loss of the system by some. Now, again, I'm not everybody. I would say there are many people that are, you know, a little older that lived in Soviet power, but they regret the loss of their leadership position globally. They would like to be back as a major player. But domestically, they like the safety net program. Many of them would say, and let me say, when I talk to my friends, they're all doing much better now. I mean, they're doing great. These are people that are doing wonderfully economically. They would say, you know what, we like the quiet of those times. You know, we valued relationships more. We weren't so overwhelmed with consumerism. Young people didn't have the anxiety to have to go out and get a job. These things they regret.
Let's in a few minutes we got left, let's talk about some of the issues in the news today. The U.S. adoptions of Russian children, the relations with Syria and Iran. Where do the Russians stand with that?
Well, we have different issues. On the adoption issue, the unfortunate reality is tens of thousands of Americans have adopted Russian children and have had wonderful results. I have a colleague who did a wonderful result. But we have a couple of dozen high-profile cases where we've had one child died, suffocated in a car, left in a hot car in Virginia. We had the very infamous case of a single parent and her mother sending back to Russia on a plane just a little boy. They couldn't handle him, I guess. So they sent him back. Literally, they just put him on the plane, and he arrived in Moscow to nothing. I mean, there was nobody waiting for him. We just had a case of a young person after that law was passed who felt abandoned. He went back. The problem is the Russians hear these, and they have the feeling that their children are being mistreated. There's been a couple dozen of these cases. So that matter, Russians feel unhappy about, and they feel it reflects a general Western view that they are not valued as people. Syria, boy, where do you go on that? Let's just say from the Russian standpoint, A, they see human rights violations on all sides. They feel this is a power matter, and they do not want to lose their final client in the region. They've already lost Iraq and Libya.
And so when we talk about, when we see it as human rights getting rid of the evil Assad regime, they see it as pushing Russia out of their last area of influence. And they're not convinced, and I think a lot of Syrians apparently not convinced that some of the opponents of Assad are any better than he is.
Yeah, well, this is the problem. Of course, I'm not an expert on Syria, but I understand from specialists that we've had fatwas issued by clergy tied with the rebels saying, for instance, all the whites to the grave. This is the Assad crowd. Kill them and send the Christians back to Lebanon. So this is a very tricky issue, and I would be very careful seeing one side is all good and the other is all bad. Certainly from the Russian standpoint, they don't.
What do you see as the future between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, I want to be hopeful. I want to be hopeful, but unfortunately, you know, we didn't see the turnaround I expected when the wall fell and the Soviet Union collapsed. So I think it's going to continue to be a very tricky, complicated relationship.
So you don't think there'll be a new era of Soviet? Because at the time when that happened, people thought, well, the Soviet Union and the United States as allies, that's a real powerful combination.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't. But, you know, this reflects hundreds of years of distance between Russia and the West. This isn't just the U.S. and Russia. Unfortunately, the relationship between Russia and Europe has been complicated, and I see no evidence that profound trend is going to change. But that doesn't mean we can't have moments of breakthrough. So let's look at arms control, for instance. Let's look at controlling nuclear weapons and proliferation. I think we and they have common interests. How about the continuing issues of terror globally? There are areas where we have common interest. I don't see why we can't find agreement.
So we'd like to thank Professor Pat Willerton of University of Arizona for coming up and talking with us on Democratic Perspective. And we have not so many announcements as usual, but we have a film coming in next month on May 7th. It's called The United States of Alec, and it's Bill Moyer's film. It's going to be presented by Democrats of the Red Rock and the Arizona Advocacy Network Foundation.
And our thanks to the Democrats of the Red Rocks and Democrats of the Verde Valley for sponsoring us. So,
and you can find this podcast on our website, vvid.org. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.